In America, the obligation of parents to support their children predates all divorce laws. The colonists carried it with them, along with much of English common law, when they came to settle on this land. And it's just been assumed that parents, whether together or divorced, are obliged to support the children they bear. Yet in 1990, 2 out of 3 American fathers not living with their children don't pay any child support. 1/3 to 1/2 of all female-headed families in this country live on income below the poverty line. Well, what happened? Has our conception of our obligation to children changed so much? In a country where creating debt is normal and paying it off burdensome, are we treating children like last year's vacation, a debt we'd prefer to ignore? I'm Susan McGinnis. For the next hour, we'll devote our conversation to child support, its payment, non-payment, and efforts to enforce reasonable support of children in the state of Alaska. My guest today is Ardith Lynch. She is Deputy Director for the State of Alaska Child Support Enforcement Division and helped to create the guidelines for child support in the state of Alaska, being a former member of the State Child Support Guidelines Committee. Before taking this job, she was an Assistant Attorney General in the city of Fairbanks. Good afternoon, Ms. Lynch, and welcome.
Thank you.
Can you begin by giving us a picture of the situation in Alaska? Are non-custodial parents supporting their children in our state?
Well, I can only speak to the child support cases that are enforced by the Child Support Enforcement Division. And not all child support cases and not all child support orders in Alaska go through our agency.
Is there a percentage that you know about?
There really are no statistics kept on the cases that we don't have. The information that I get from people in the court system, they have a feel for about that half the orders go through the Child Support Enforcement Division and the other half are just handled privately between the parents. And so because they are that half is private between the parents, there's really no way of knowing whether they're being paid or not paid.
And of that half that goes through Child Support Enforcement Division, what's paid and what's not?
In 1989, we collected about 37 cents on the dollar. 37% of the child support that was ordered to be paid in 1989 was paid in 1989.
That's not a lot.
That's not a lot. That means that of every dollar that a custodial parent was supposed to receive, the average custodial parent received less than 40 cents.
And is that's an average, so we can assume that some of those custodial parents aren't receiving any money, and some custodial parents are receiving some?
Yes.
Okay. And you mentioned to me before we sat down today that there is a number in arrearages also that's just backed up debt that's not being paid. Is that a great percentage of the money that child support enforcement deals with?
Yes, because only about 40% of the child support that's ordered in a given month or a given year is paid, there's an unpaid child support obligation that accrues every month. In 1989, I think we went into 1989 with about $110 million in unpaid child support. And we ended 1989 with about $156 million in unpaid child support through the State of Alaska Child Support Enforcement Division.
So you're paddling as fast as you can and not getting very far. Is that the case?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So even if we had started 1989 with a clean slate, with everybody paid in full, and collected the amount that was paid last year, we still would have gone in the hole about $30 million.
Just in Alaska?
Yes.
Which is the lowest population of any state. What do you think's going on? Has our sense of obligation about children changed culturally?
I'm not so sure it's changed, or that maybe we're just becoming more aware of the problem. As you probably know, the federal government has become more involved in child support enforcement over the last few years and has required all the state child support enforcement agencies to improve their methods of collecting child support. And as a result, I think we're becoming more aware of what the problem is and how difficult it is to collect child support. I think perhaps the problem's always been there.
Hmm. The federal government is becoming more and more involved because if money is not collected from the non-custodial parent, eventually that burden's going to rest on the federal government. Is that right? To
right.
support that family?
Right. Part of the Aid to Families with Dependent Children program, AFDC, what we think of as welfare or public assistance, part of that, the funding for that program is paid by the federal government. So as a condition for a state to receive that federal funding, every state has to have a state child support enforcement agency. And that enforcement agency has to meet certain federal regulations. And if the state child support enforcement agency isn't in compliance with the federal laws, then the state's federal funding for public assistance is jeopardized.
They penalize you.
Right.
So that ultimately the people who need the money don't get the money, but they're not a burden on the federal government, they're a burden on the state government. Because
right.
in essence, the Fed said, you're not doing what you're supposed to do, so we're not going to take care of your people who are in need.
Right. So the federal government funds part of the public assistance program, and they also fund more than two-thirds of the state child support enforcement division through matching funds. And so the federal government became more concerned about the increasing burden of public dependency, which they believe is caused in part by what they call the absent parents' failure to support the children.
And an absent parent is a non-custodial parent.
Someone who is absent from the home is what mm-hmm. that expression means. And so starting in 1984, they began to step up the measures that were required of states to collect child support enforcement. And in 1988, they passed the Family Support Act, which is the bill that people refer to as the welfare reform legislation, mm-hmm. which includes more new measures for child support enforcement, many of which come into effect this year in 1990.
Daniel Patrick Moynihan called this the parental responsibility bill. He said that the obligation is to put it back on the shoulders of the parents. Does it do that in your mind, even though it has to pass through various federal and state agencies to do so?
Well, I think it will help. I think it will help. One measure that came into law as a result of the 1984 law was a requirement that every person who was more than a month behind in their child support obligation had to be put under wage withholding, which people would think of as garnishment. It's an order typical to garnishment. And the federal government thought that that requirement was really going to increase collections drastically and dramatically. And in fact, that really has not happened. It has helped somewhat, but from the numbers I gave you a few minutes ago, you can tell that we're not anywhere near 100% compliance yet. So starting this November, any case that is enforced by the Child Support Enforcement Division that has an order that is issued for the first time or modified after November 1st of 1990 will fall under immediate income withholding. The person paying support will not be in arrearage before child support payments start to be withheld from his or her income.
What happens there? Say I am the non-custodial parent. I have a job. The state steps in, comes to my employer, and what?
Yes. Serves something called a withholding order on the employer, which, if you're not behind in your child support, is going to be for the amount of your monthly child support obligation. And so that your child support will be deducted from your pay just like your federal taxes are and your Social Security deduction and other required deductions.
And what if I scream bloody murder and say I can write that check myself?
There are a couple exceptions to immediate income withholding, and one of them is if the two parents agree in writing to not have immediate income withholding and to an alternate arrangement. Another exception is something called the good cause exception, which is that if, say, an order is modified after this November and the person has been making their child support payments on a regular basis since the parties divorced, that person would obviously fall within a good cause exception not to have immediate income withholding. But the sad news is I did some research into cases that were filed in 1988. So those cases are less than 2 years past the date of divorce and the child support order, and 80% of those cases are now at least 1 month behind in child support. In less than 2 years since the divorce, 55 cents of every dollar ordered in child support has been paid. So there is a problem with people not paying child support immediately after the divorce, and maybe the immediate income withholding requirement will help those children get support without a delay that is caused by the notice that has to be given to people before any enforcement can take place.
And once again, this is just pertaining to the 50% of the cases, or roughly 50% of child support cases, which is handled by the Enforcement Division.
Right. The Family Support Act does contain a requirement that in 1994, all child support orders will be under immediate income withholding.
Anything that's gone through a court then, anything
right.
that is that other than Jack and I sit down and we say, okay, I'll pay so much and you pay so much in the privacy of our own now separated home.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Let me break in just long enough to remind people that we're talking to Ardith Lynch today. Ms. Lynch is the Deputy Director for the State of Alaska Child Support Enforcement Division, and we're talking about child support. I'm Susan McInnes. Let's back up and let people who may not know get a picture of what it costs to raise a child in the state of Alaska. Now, I don't think that question can actually be answered because it depends a lot on age, special circumstances, illnesses, special needs by the child, and then, of course, the income bracket that the parents, single or dually, are in. But is there a way that question can be approached?
Well, there is a way it can be approached. In response to the 1984 legislation, which encouraged all states to have guidelines. At that time, they didn't need to be binding guidelines, but every state was supposed to have guidelines for setting child support orders. Governor Sheffield appointed a commission to study child support guidelines, and they relied on a study of intact families, two-parent families, and what percentage of income an intact family spends on supporting their children. And that study found that except at the very low and very high income brackets, that parents spent 20% of their income supporting one child, 20% of their net income supporting one child, 27% of their income supporting two children, 33% supporting three.
Does this include rent and mortgage on the house, a percentage of electric and gas and all the rest? It's not just shoes and food and shirts.
Right. It's a pro rata share of everything. If you have, two or three children, obviously you're going to need to live in a bigger house or apartment than you do as a couple or a single person.
So 20%. And I read somewhere that people at lower incomes tend to spend a greater percentage and people at higher incomes tend to spend a lesser percentage.
That's what the research indicates, that there's a certain amount that it costs to support a child and that you will spend supporting a child. So if you're at a low income bracket, you're going to spend a higher percentage of your income. And similarly, there's only so much that you can spend on a child. And so that if you're at a very high income level, that percentage of your income that you spend on a child is going to drop off.
Also because you've got more discretionary income and presumably can do other things with it once you take care of the child's obligation. Right. Thing I wanted to turn to. So, what is the percentage? Is there an average percentage of child support post-divorce, and is it close to that 20%?
What Alaska's guidelines say is that for cases where the parents don't share custody, and that gets into a more complicated formula, but for a situation where one parent has the child more than 70% of the time, the percentage of adjusted income is 20%. The income is adjusted for mandatory deductions like your federal income tax, Social Security, union dues, and for any daycare expenses that you have for this child because they're a necessary cost of going to work. Also for child support orders that you may have for older children. 20% for one child, 27% for two kids. 33% for three kids, and an additional 3% thereafter.
So those guidelines have pretty much gone with what the study said for the Sheffield Committee.
Right.
And is that, what is your opinion about that amount of money? Is that burdensome? Is that appropriate for someone who's separated from that family and gone on to live another life?
If the intent is that the parents should continue to support the children in the same style that they were living in before the divorce, that's the best method that I know of to figure out what that is. I think it leaves open a question as to whether it costs more to support children as a single parent than it does as an intact family. You may have to rely more on child care. There may be other expenses that in a two-parent family you would not have.
And there's the inevitable reduced income if both parents were working before and now one parent is working after.
Right. Mm-hmm. So the idea of these guidelines in the state of Alaska is that the custodial parent pays the 20% of his or her income in kind by paying the rent, buying the groceries, doing that other, all those other things associated with raising a child, and the non-custodial parent writes a check every month.
And is that factored into the guidelines as well? If I am at home with my children and I have certain homemaking duties to keep that family intact?
You are presumed to be spending that 20% of your income supporting your child. If the non-custodial parent's support obligation is not increased or decreased as a result of what the custodial parent earns. So the custodial parent can be earning virtually nothing. The non-custodial parent whose income is, say, $30,000 a year is going to pay the same amount of child support as another non-custodial parent whose income is $30,000 a year, regardless of what their former spouses do for a living and what their respective incomes is.
Right. Who do you serve? You serve people whose child support agreements have broken down, I presume?
I'd say the agency serves a variety of people. The agency is open to both people who are recipients of public assistance and people who are not. Anyone can use the services of the Child Support Enforcement Division. People who are on public assistance are required to have their child support payments go through the state. But there are many public assistance recipients or non-public assistance recipients who choose to do that also. Our caseload is about evenly divided between public assistance and non-public assistance cases. And people can come to the Child Support Enforcement Division basically at any point of the process. Let me give you an idea of what we do.
Sure.
We can establish paternity of children who are born out of wedlock, you know, whether that birth occurred a week ago or whether it occurred 17 years ago, actually even 18 years ago.
Up to the time of majority.
Right. We do that for people who are receiving public assistance and people who are not. People who are not receiving a public assistance just have to complete an application for services. We can get a support order for people if there is no support order already. If there is a support order, we can enforce that support order. And we have some tools available that are not available to private parties. In addition to the wage withholding that we talked about a few minutes ago, we also do credit bureau reporting. We can attach permanent fund dividend. And we can attach IRS refunds to satisfy child support obligations.
How about out of state? I've moved to Nebraska. Can you get my income tax withholding?
Yes.
Or refund, rather?
Yes. Yes. Things get a little more complicated if somebody moves out of the state and is not voluntarily complying with the child support. In essence, what we do is refer the case to the child support agency in the other state, and then it is really up to that other state agency to enforce the case. And so generally it takes longer. You're really subject to what the state laws might be in the other state.
Mm-hmm. Are there reciprocal arrangements between states?
Yes, all 50 states and some foreign countries as well. So people can come into the Child Support Enforcement Division caseload as soon as they get a divorce or dissolution, or they can try things on their own for a few years, and for whatever reason, come to us. The payments don't have to be in arrearage. The payments can be on time. One of the ways that we function is as an independent accounting service. If people get divorced with young children, you know, they are looking at maintaining adequate and accurate payment records over a considerable time span, and that's what we do. You know, we enter all the payments made and in and payments going out on a computer, and so somebody can come in 15 years later and know that their payments have or have not been made on time.
Don't
through
have
all
to
that.
Keep it in a shoebox.
Right.
And, yeah, plow through it.
Mm-hmm. And if people got divorced several years ago, they could come in and apply for services. Either parent can make that application to have the payments go through the Child Support Enforcement Division.
And it seems to me in that case that you're a neutral party.
Yes.
If this marriage was stormy and the divorce is stormy and we're not able to see the same sentence on the page when we each read it, you people provide that for us. You provide a neutral party who takes it, collects the information, as you say, and makes sure that the amount of money that I pay gets to my ex-spouse or
right.
is gotten to me
mm-hmm.
either way.
Mm-hmm.
So even if I'm willing to pay, you're a good person to come see in some ways, right?
Right, unless you're somebody who's willing to keep 18 years of canceled checks
yeah.
available in case somebody does say several years later you weren't making all the payments you were supposed to make.
Is that going to cost me?
No.
Free?
No. The only costs associated with our services are, and these are fairly rare, are some miscellaneous costs like filing fees on interstate cases, those fees are waived if people are unable to pay them. Another cost that the federal government requires us to seek reimbursement for is the cost of blood tests. And one of the provisions of the Family Support Act is that genetic tests, paternity tests, be available to people in contested paternity cases. So if we are prosecuting a case on behalf of a child who is born out of wedlock, and either parent says, I want blood tests, the mother or the alleged father mm-hmm. says, I want blood tests, they are entitled to those. And if the alleged father is proven to be the father, we are required to seek reimbursement for the cost of the blood tests, which run about $400. But for cases where just payments come through us, there is no charge at all.
Is there a statute of limitations, or does child support enforcement carry right through until the age of majority of all my children?
Okay. There is no statute of limitations on the establishment of paternity while the child is under 18. Okay, so you can't establish paternity of a child up to age 18. There is a statute of limitations on collection of judgments, and unpaid child support is considered a judgment each month that the payment isn't made, and that statute of limitation is 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody can go back 10 years for child support that was ordered in a divorce decree or something.
And at 9 years, 364 days, does tomorrow end it, or can I come and say, I have never asked for this, and I know it's right at the 11th hour, but I really do need time to ask you to help me. Can that be extended?
Well, the 10 years would cut off, if you waited another month, it would cut off the first month 10 years ago.
Oh.
So you can go back the last...
Got it. All right.
120 months.
Right.
10 years times 12 months a year.
We have been talking about custodial and non-custodial parents. Mostly in this world, it is the father who is the non-custodial parent and the mother who is the custodial parent. And there has been much in the last couple of years, probably in the last 5 or 6 years, talked about the feminization of poverty. Is it your sense, and again, this is not something that's precisely within your job description to answer, but is it your sense that the payment or non-payment of child support makes a great difference in whether someone is impoverished or not in this country?
Yes, I think it does make a great difference. I think one of the things that's very important about child support is not only that it gets set at an adequate level, but that it gets paid regularly. If you can't rely on your child support payment, I think it must be very hard to work to pay daycare, to know that you have all these fixed expenses and that you may not be able to meet them at the end of the month.
It's a good chance, in my mind anyway, that it also makes a difference between a job or welfare. Because if I can't count on, or if a woman can't count on that money coming in, she may, her recourse may have to be AFDC, and that's very difficult to get off of, right?
Yeah, I can't speak for how difficult it is to get off of, and that's one of the changes in this welfare reform bill is extended benefits when people do go back to work, so that they don't necessarily lose out immediately on the medical provisions of public assistance. But, you know, certainly, and we know that daycare is a very high expense, especially for parents of young children, and one that has to be met if you're going to be able to work.
Mm-hmm. There are opposition groups forming in recent years to the enforcement of child support payments, which are, in Alaska, I think there is a group called Alaskan Moms and Dads, and I think there is also a Second Families group. I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of that one. What's the nature of their opposition to child support enforcement, and is the opposition to your agency in particular?
Well, our agency is, I think, probably a natural focus of some of the opposition. And some of the opposition is aimed at our enforcement techniques, and we are required by law to enforce child support orders and to use certain things like income withholding. And, you know, there are those people who have ignored their obligations for several years, have taken on new obligations, second families, and want some consideration for those second families when we go to collect child support.
Because the dollar is ever shrinking, having added a second family to a first family.
Right. And because now they're $10,000 or perhaps more in a rearage on their obligation to their first family.
And do you ever make adjustments in that case?
We do make adjustments if the second family is at the poverty level, and the guidelines for setting child support in Alaska specifically allow for that. But, you know, it certainly is difficult because the children of the first relationship are certainly entitled to support. And it is sometimes hard to justify giving consideration to the second families when the first families have been ignored for so long.
So you would call them prime in all cases except for poverty of the second family?
Yes.
What happens when you locate someone who has been hard to find and who is a long time in arrears?
Well, the first step, which is required, is income withholding. So we will try to satisfy the child support obligation from their wages or other income. That person is also reported to the credit bureau as being delinquent. We take the permanent fund dividend, submit them to IRS for tax refund. We can file liens against property. We can pursue remedies such as criminal non-support and contempt of court in appropriate cases.
In which case, is a person fined or sent to jail or both? And is the fine the amount of the child support?
Generally, the person is not fined. In contempt cases, the person can be told that they will go to jail unless they pay the child support, or they can be put in jail until they do pay the child support. And in criminal non-support cases, it's a criminal offense. And so, yes, the person can be jailed for a specific period of time in order to pay restitution.
But in the long run, jail is not helpful in as much as it takes someone out of the wage-earning position.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Are there reasons that custodial parents don't ask for assistance from you or don't ask for child support?
Probably. I think some custodial parents would just as soon get on with their lives and shoulder the burden themselves and not be involved in the hassles. And while I can certainly appreciate that point of view, I also think that a parent has a responsibility to their child to see that their child is supported with an adequate lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, to keep the connection with the other wage earner, because that person is also responsible for
yes.
the child. To let people know who've tuned in late, we're talking today about child support, its payment, non-payment, and enforcement where necessary, and talking today with Ardith Lynch, who is the Deputy Director of the Child Support Enforcement Division for the State of Alaska. Her office is here in Fairbanks. Some people who, again, generally the absent father, who have real difficulty with the amount of child support, connected with visitation, saying that my visitation rights are not being carried out or allowed, permitted, and so why should I then support that child? I'm being alienated mm-hmm. from this child. Does child support enforcement take that into consideration, and what do you do about it if you do?
We don't take it into consideration. There's a specific state law that says they are not interrelated subjects.
Period.
That payment of child support is not affected by interference with visitation. So it is something that we cannot take into account. Also, the federal regulations under which this agency operates really do limit us to nothing but the enforcement of child support. We don't get involved in custody disputes or visitation disputes between the parents.
So you can send people to the appropriate agency, so to speak, in
right.
that case, and otherwise it would probably be a real mare's nest, wouldn't it?
Yes.
There's also objections that, see, much of this I get from letters to the editor in the paper where people have said, my ex-wife doesn't need that much money to raise the kids. She doesn't send me any kind of itemized bill, for example, showing me that this was necessary or that was necessary. So I think I should be able to set my own amount. What is your response to that?
Well, if their order is set in compliance with the guidelines, as I said earlier, it's set to mirror the same percentage of their income that they were paying to support their child during the marriage. And so, you know, all the child support order does is preserve that same level of support for that child.
Yeah, but now she's got a better job. She's making more money than I am.
All that means is that the child's standard of living is going to go up.
Oh, but she's not going to use that money only to support that child. This extra money she doesn't need, now she's going to go out and spend it on herself.
I think in response to that, it would be very helpful to have a study on how much it costs to raise a child in Alaska. But, you know, when you consider that daycare is several hundred dollars a month, sometimes over $400 a month for a preschool child, a toddler, $300 a month for a preschooler, and doesn't go down an awful lot even for an after-school child, and that is a fixed sum each and every month. And then you consider the cost of clothing a child in Alaska, of feeding a child, after-school activities, their portion of the rent, uninsured medical expenses. There's really just a host of things that we spend money on. And as a family, I think when you go to Safeway and you write the check out, you don't think, oh, you know, I'm spending $10 on diapers and $10 on formula this month. And it would really be a burden on a custodial parent to expect that custodial parent to sit down and itemize the receipts. Certainly it might be helpful to have the parents do that to work out their disagreements, to be able to say, you know, this is what it cost me to outfit this kid in school clothes this month. And certainly a child's expenses don't stay constant every month. The month of September is probably much more expensive for school-aged children because they do get outfitted for school and maybe get a new winter coat and boots and all those other things we need. And then in another month, maybe they've got a lot of uninsured medical expenses.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe in another month, you know, it's birthday parties or Christmas or whatever. And maybe there's a few months where, in fact, the child support is more than adequate to cover the out-of-pocket costs. But you've also got to consider the other costs that are associated with raising the child, the gas you put in your car to run him to McDonald's and all the other activities that children are involved in.
Are most childhood support agreements or judgments that you know of ones that will increase according to increasing costs of raising children over the year, or are most of them fixed?
Most of them are fixed. In the guidelines, there is a specific provision for being able to change the amount of the child support order if the parent's income increases or decreases and the child support itself would change by more than 15%. so that if a parent's income, you know, went down for some involuntary reason, they changed jobs and because they were laid off and the next best job they could get is less money, they should be able to go back to court and more or less automatically under those circumstances have the child support modified.
But there is the factor that a 2-year-old is probably less expensive to raise, barring unusual circumstances, than a 15-year-old.
Possibly. I think, you know, those are the areas where it really gets into the individual family circumstances. A 2-year-old that requires full-time daycare is not going to be that inexpensive. And a child of 2 working parents, especially parents, you know, post-divorce who probably both do need to work, will require full-time daycare.
Does it make sense to you, as a person who works in this trench, so to speak, that divorced parents should be in contact with each other regarding changed circumstances? I mean, I know in many cases it's not practical, but is it logical to try and do that? Johnny needs orthodontia, for example.
It would certainly be helpful. Even though the mother and the father are no longer married to each other, they're still the parents of this child, and they will stay the parents of this child forever. And I think it's probably in the child's best interest that they do remain in contact with each other, in most cases.
So in as far as they're able to negotiate out reduced or enhanced circumstances, reduced or enhanced needs, changes that, in the child's life that each parent should know about.
It's certainly helpful.
Right. I want to return to the changes made in 1984 and 88, and I'm not sure where it was, but it seems to me that there was a provision added by the federal government that if the non-custodial parent has insurance through work, that the children may still go under those insurance benefits, whether or not that parent is custodial. Is that the case?
That's the case. Actually, that's one of the things that the child support enforcement agencies are required to do. We are required to obtain medical support orders as part of child support orders. And similarly, the courts who issue divorce decrees or dissolution decrees are required to order medical insurance if it's available to the parents at reasonable cost. And at reasonable cost is defined as group insurance through the employer. So if somebody is getting a divorce, they are required to keep their children on their medical insurance, and they do receive a credit against the child support obligation if there's any cost in keeping the kids on the insurance.
So that's helpful.
Yes.
Have we spoken sufficiently about people who are on AFDC? My understanding is that child support payments ordered do not necessarily reach the parent who's receiving AFDC. Is that accurate? And what is the system there?
The system, which I can give you a brief outline of without going deeply into federal regulations, is that when a person goes on public assistance, they assign their right to child support to the state, and that is their right to the ongoing child support as well as any unpaid child support that has accumulated. And then the state child support enforcement agency tries to collect that child support. Any month in which we make a collection, in which child support is paid, the AFDC family will receive the first $50 without affecting the grant at all. It's something called the $50 pass-through. At some point, hopefully, we are able to get child support paid regularly, and the regular child support payments may be enough to disqualify a family for AFDC.
So that
depends on what other income is coming into the family.
And the mother might receive AFDC up to the point where child support payments became regular, and then the AFDC would inform the parent that she is no longer, or within X period of time, will no longer be eligible.
Right.
And then
right.
She's free to take that solid money of child support enforcement payments, and one would assume find work for herself.
Right.
Or himself
right.
In that case.
See, AFDC families are entitled to have some income, so, you know, a person's AFDC grant is affected by the amount of the income, but a person could be receiving a small AFDC grant because they do have income from outside employment, and so a child support payment could be enough to disqualify that particular family, whereas it might not be enough to disqualify a different family.
Do you think that works well?
I think it works fairly well. I mean, there are certainly cases where we are able, through income withholding, to get people paying child support regularly. And when you know it's coming in regularly, then you can count on it. Then it becomes a source of income for your family. It's not just something that is extra money. That's certainly one comment that I've heard about child support. Well, you know, it's just extra money. Well, it certainly is just extra money if you can't rely on it regularly like you can rely on your paycheck. You have to treat it that way.
That's a windfall if it comes only periodically.
Right.
Right. But probably a lot of pain if it's not. Before the guidelines were established, there was a small book written by a man named Joseph Lieberman in 1986, I think, and it's called Child Support. He was the Attorney General for the state of Connecticut, and that book, incidentally, is in most libraries if people are interested in it. It tracks the child support system and how child support amounts were come to. His charge from several studies was that judges in the past, before guidelines were established for the amount, were pretty inconsistent in the amount of payments that they set. Do you have any experience with the past system as compared to the present system, and can you compare it in the state of Alaska?
Yes. Before I became an assistant attorney general, I was in private practice here in Fairbanks and did some divorce cases, and certainly child support was inconsistent. And that was one of the problems with the system. You could not tell your client, as an attorney, you could not tell your client, this is what your child support payment will be. You just had no way of knowing. Whether you represented the father or the mother, it was just impossible to know. And I also think it's very hard, actually, sometimes for parents to sit down and figure out how much it does cost to support a child because, as I said earlier, when you go to Safeway and write out that check, you don't divide it up between who's eating what. And you don't consider, well, you know, the child's eating school lunches and things like that, and because so many expenses of a family are commingled, I think it's real hard for parents to know exactly how much it's going to cost to raise that child.
And so very much was left up to the discretion of the judge who wasn't in the family.
Right. 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 Who could only, you know, based on their own experience with other cases, set child support at a reasonable level. And now, one of the great advantages of the guidelines is that there is consistency, so that the person who's making $30,000 a year in Fairbanks with one child is paying the same amount of child support as another person in Fairbanks, or another person in Anchorage who's making $30,000 a year with one child, assuming that all the other exceptions don't apply in their case. And the other thing is that they can know that for the rest of their child's minority, they're going to be paying 20% of their income, unless the guidelines change. But it does give them a ballpark figure to know, so that if they do want to start a second family, they can say, can I afford this? Can I afford another child? Just like intact families make that decision.
Or if their $30,000 a year job leaves, they will know that they will pay 20% of their $18,000 a year job if that's the next job they get.
Right. Right, if that's the next job they can get. Or that if they get promotions or raises or whatever, that eventually their child support will be increased, but it will be 20%. So,
are there provisions for people to appeal to you if they think that the situation is unfair on either side?
It depends. If it's a court order, no, the person can't appeal to us.
Go to the court.
Right, go to the court. But the agency does have the power to set child support orders administratively if there is no court order for support. And then, yes, there is a whole appeal process that the person can go through.
I wonder if you would sit back and give some advice to custodial parents and or non-custodial parents You mentioned a minute ago how difficult it might be to figure out a budget of how much it takes to pay for a child. What sort of advice would you give to parents contemplating a divorce, let's say?
Well, I think first I'd give my advice to parents contemplating children to say, you will have this child for 18 years, perhaps more, and you will support this child, and children are not cheap. And to parents contemplating a divorce, it's fairly easy to pick up the paperwork to fill out the guidelines. There are worksheets available with the dissolution packets at the courthouse, and they can go through them and figure out what the child support obligation is. And because enforcement mechanisms are improving, I think that the person paying child support should count on having to pay that child support. Obviously, our collection statistics say that there are a lot of people out there that don't think they're going to have to pay child support, and they're not doing themselves a favor to have $10,000 in unpaid child support add up, and because someday it probably will catch up with them.
What do you think of the dissolution laws relative to child support? They made it a no-fault divorce situation, is that correct?
Yes.
Don't need a lawyer. We can sit down together and determine how we will dissolve this marriage. Its impact on child support?
Well, child support guidelines have certainly improved that. One of the problems with dissolutions before child support guidelines was parents could agree to any amount of child support without ever really sitting down and figuring out how expensive it was going to be. You know, perhaps the wife that stayed home during the marriage was now going to have to go out to work, and if you agree to $200 a month support before you realize how much daycare, I keep coming back to, is going to cost, and if you've never sat down and figured out how much you spend on your kid's school clothes, then you're going to be in for a pretty rude awakening after the divorce. Now that we have guidelines and child support agreements are supposed to comply with those guidelines, parents are not supposed to be able to make agreements that go through court without having them comply with the guidelines or fall within one of the few exceptions.
So one of the jobs of the court is to say, wait a minute, that's not enough, or do you know what you're doing here? That's a massive amount of child support.
Right. That's exactly right. And, you know, sometimes, you know, there are exceptions to the guidelines, and sometimes those agreements are approved, but probably more often they are not approved. And so with that, it certainly acts as a good control on parents' ability to give away their child support or to agree, and perhaps in good faith, to an amount of child support that is just not realistic because nobody's ever sat down to figure it out.
And because it's all tied up emotionally as well.
Certainly.
Yeah. I want to be a good parent, so I may say I'll pay a huge amount, and it's not money I have, it's just wishful money.
Right, and if it's not money you have, then you're going to fall behind. And,
right. As an attorney, would you advise people who are divorcing on both sides to get an attorney? Or do you think the dissolution laws, the way they're set up, are fairly protective of both sides?
I think as an attorney, I would certainly have an attorney review the paperwork. There may be assets of your marriage that have never occurred to you as assets. For example, somebody's retirement fund as an asset that should be divided up between the parents or should certainly be accounted for somehow. There are custodial arrangements that look good on paper but may not work so well in reality that somebody who's had some experience with divorces can say to you, you know, what do you think about this? So it's so hard to answer that question when you consider the varying degrees of education and experience and the emotional level that people might be at. Some people part very amicably. Some people do not.
But an attorney is a good tool in this case because an attorney has a heightened awareness of the issue of divorce.
Certainly, with any luck, they're somewhat removed emotionally from the process, so they can be a more objective person, and do generally have the benefit of having represented other people in divorce cases, knowing what some of the pitfalls are, having represented people in litigation after the divorce, for example. You know, if it's nothing more than making sure that the necessary paperwork to transfer things back and forth has been taken care of.
We haven't talked about joint custody and child support. Is that another wrinkle?
It is another wrinkle. You know, there's joint custody and joint custody. That term means a lot to people. And what the child support guidelines talk about is shared custody, which means that both parents have the children more than 30% of the year, 110 overnights a year. And so it is certainly possible for the parents to have, quote, joint custody, but for the child to reside primarily with one parent 90 or even 100% of the year. But the guidelines do take into consideration arrangements where the child does reside with both parents for a considerable portion of the year.
And in that case, is what happens to the amount of money that is paid? Does it just change so that the person who is not residing with the child pays for the period of non-residence?
No. It's easier to explain on paper. But what happens is that each parent's, let's say we're doing one child, so each parent's 20% is figured out. And then they pay, on paper, that 20% while the child is residing with the other parent. But in fact, what you do when you're at the bottom of this formula is you subtract the lower amount from the higher amount so that only one parent pays support to the other. You know, it's not necessary for both parents to be writing checks to each other 6 months out of the year if that's what their custody arrangement is. One parent pays the difference between the two child support amounts.
All right. That makes sense. I don't think we needed paper for that. Two questions. I'll ask them back to back. The child support enforcement agencies of the United States, which are state-run, governed by federal laws, represent a slow, because it's happened over years and incrementally, but a big foot into the door of the privacy of the American home. Is this Big Brother in your mind? Are there great disadvantages to having such a large involvement in the privacy?
Well, it's not a private concern when children become public dependents because they're not getting child support. And that's what the public assistance program is about. Children who aren't getting supported adequately are on public assistance. And so you and I and the rest of the taxpayers are bearing that burden. So it's no longer just a private interest. And I think we all have an interest in seeing that the children of this country are supported adequately.
Is there ever a chance that child support is simply going to be a voluntary issue again?
Certainly not the way things are going. I mean, what the federal laws have shown us over the last 6 years is that enforcement mechanisms are being stepped up. You know, now, especially with this immediate income withholding provision, that child support should become something automatic that is taken from the non-custodial parent's wages without having to be a discretionary payment, without them having to sit down and make the decision, am I going to pay this month?
Mm-hmm.
One big advantage that we haven't talked to about immediate income withholding is that it does remove the stigma of wage withholding. It does not mean anymore that you are not supporting your children voluntarily. It simply means you have children that you don't live with, and you have a legal obligation to support them, and this is how you're meeting it.
No one's garnishing your wages.
Right.
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 Yeah. And so that should make it more palatable as well.
Mm-hmm.
Where are the flaws in the system from your perspective, federally and in terms of the state?
Well, the flaws in the system is that we can't do a better job of getting people to pay their child support voluntarily or involuntarily. you know, 37 cents on the dollar of child support paid certainly doesn't speak well for the support that the children of the state are getting. Even though income withholding is not mandatory in all cases today, we, as the Child Support Enforcement Agency, most of our payments come from garnishments, not from voluntary payments.
So the flaws really are with those who are ultimately responsible in your mind, not so much as the way the system is working, but...
Right. But I am aware that our job is to collect child support from people who won't pay it voluntarily. And I wish that it didn't take as long as it sometimes does for that to happen.
Do you think your 37 cents on the dollar will be increased radically once wage withholding takes place, or will it be a small?
It will be a small change because the immediate wage withholding will just apply to orders that are issued for the first time or modified after this November. And so it will just be a few orders every month that come under immediate income withholding. And, you know, I hope that in, say, 5 years we can look back and say, yes, this really did improve things, but it's not going to happen overnight on November 1st.
And do you have thoughts for where the system can be further improved?
I think the system can be further improved in some education to parents, to people who are about to become parents or thinking about becoming parents, and perhaps not even thinking about becoming parents. Certainly there are a lot of children born out of wedlock in Alaska as well as other states, and people need to be aware that they will have an obligation to support those children.
So helping people be aware of how long and how much it will take to raise a child. Mm-hmm. What can you do to help teens? I mean, 3 babies a day, I think the stat is, in the state of Alaska are born to teenagers.
I don't think I have the answer to that one. Certainly telling them, you know, this is what child support is. If you are the non-custodial parent for 18 years, you will be paying 20% of your income to support a child. Mm-hmm. And translate that into real dollars.
We've been talking in this last hour to Ardith Lynch. She is the Deputy Director of the Child Support Enforcement Division and is here in Fairbanks in her office. She has been a participant in creating the guidelines for child support in the state of Alaska and formerly an Assistant Attorney General in Fairbanks. I want to thank you for joining us today. It's been an interesting conversation. We've been talking about child support.
Thank you.